Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Joins us for the weekly update on this Friday morning. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Oh, it's good again to be with you. And not as tired as last week after the Hasana, but I'm pretty close to it.
What happened over Shabbos Sheva Brachos in Baltimore? Are the people in Baltimore's Jewish community just as concerned about the issues of the day as the folks that are bugging you constantly up here in the New York, New Jersey area?
Yeah, but they get less opportunities to do so, so they take advantage of it. But Baruch Hashem, at the Sheva Brachos, people were quite understanding. It depends how much they had to drink about how understanding they were. But such a wonderful community and wonderful people. And Baruch Hashem Tzvi and Daniela Moskowitz now are very happy and wish them many years of happiness and good health together.
Yes, Mazal Tov again. And I guess even down there, people are just as concerned about this amazing world of ours.
And confused,
I can imagine. Well, it's no secret what the biggest question of the week is. I was asked it 100 times. I would assume that means you were asked it about 10,000 times in the last few days. So I'll ask you, will, in fact, Jonathan Pollard be a free man before the holiday of Passover?
I don't think so. I'm afraid, and as you know, for many years on this show when we've discussed it, you know that I've been very involved with him, visited him in prison. We've regularly interceded with the last four presidents or five, that it would always be tied to some larger context until at least next year when his parole comes up, and he is due for a parole hearing actually now, and he waived it, but not because he was refusing it, as some of the reports said, but because, as I understand it, they're waiting for information because he has a legal case pending, and he wanted to wait to see the outcome of that. In the same way that there were reports that he had refused this to be part of the deal,
right?
And said that he didn't want his freedom to come at the expense of the lives of the people in Israel, Jews in Israel. But it seems that he has said that in the past. But I believe that he really said that he would consider it if that would come up. I mean, obviously, he wouldn't turn it down if he's given the chance to get out. But as you know, the deal is in free fall and doesn't look like this issue will be resolved anytime soon, and certainly not the release. And as you know, the White House has said all along that the president has not even considered it yet.
Right, and we'll get to why it's in a free fall, the potential deal, in a moment. But let's go back for a second. So waiving the right, I guess you'd call it, or the procedure to a parole hearing, you're saying it's because there's something legally that might be to his advantage to wait and have that hearing at a different time.
That's what I was told is the reason, contrary to some of the press reports.
Right.
You know, it's 28 years. It shouldn't have to be part of a deal. It should be humanitarian, just a matter of justice. And he should be let go.
It's
a political pawn, and it shouldn't be a bargaining chip one way or the other. And then the press interpreted some of my comments saying, well, you know, he's up for parole, therefore it's of lesser and lesser value as time goes on, because ultimately at some point he will be let go, we hope. Although, as you saw from the reaction, the editorials, the vicious editorials, some of the comments that this evokes, this will not go down very easily. Even today, the level of intensity of feeling.
Are you referring to comments by certain Jewish members of Congress?
I'm not talking about them necessarily. I was talking about editorials in the Washington Post, New York Times, many other places, comments made by law enforcement people, former, even though there are many, many who have come out for a long time saying it's time to let him go.
Right.
But what's clear is that the reaction will be very strong, and the anti-Semites and non-anti-Semites, but people who want to take advantage of the opportunity to smash Israel, or others who legitimately, and even some in the Jewish community, who feel that, given his crime, that there should be no intercession or extra special effort.
I got to give you my perspective on this, and you may say, oh, you're such a simpleton, Siegel. You know, some people object to, I understand the objection of it being part of a deal. I understand that. But two things. Number one, if in fact Israel is releasing hundreds of prisoners anyway, would it be that bad if in fact he was included in such a type of a deal? And the other thing I would say is there are people who fear, and by the way, I think that's the right word. There are people who fear, especially in our community, that when he is released, there will be a celebratory atmosphere in Israel and the Jewish world. And I ask you, Malcolm, is that so bad when watching all these hundreds and hundreds of murderers, prisoners be released, and in fact, every one of their releases turns into a massive party by the enemy?
Very short-lived ones, and they know that they're staged. I do not believe that that will be the case. I don't think that's what he wants. I think from my discussions with him that he will go quietly. He wants to build his life with his wife. He has been, you know, in isolation for 7 years, in prison for more than 10,000 days. I think he wants the peace and quiet and to rebuild his life. He's expressed remorse. I don't think that the cases are parallel. The release of the prisoners, you know, I was once at a prisoner exchange with Syria after the Six-Day War, and I saw how they stood in the hilltops applauding, and when you saw just on the other side, and thank God somebody got a film of it, they took him literally and just threw him into trucks. These people, the prisoners who get out from the PA, you know, receive $50,000 or $100,000, and then they receive monthly pensions.
Right, as noted.
Because they're really not treated, they claim they're not treated that well, not given enough assistance, but we don't operate by the same rules. This is not a comparable case. He wasn't a terrorist, and he will, I think, want to live a quiet life, and there will not be massive celebrations when he comes to Israel. Obviously, people will go and welcome. There are people who have worked on his behalf for many years.
Understood. And on the first point, I mean, I hear where you're going with the first point, but you don't like the point that at least get some value for the hundreds that are being released.
No, I think if he can get out, he should get out.
Right. Understood.
If the opportunity exists, and you know, there's no benefit to refusing at that point. But the deal was never, I think, as close as the media try to portray it, and especially after the speech in Kuwait at the Arab League by Abbas, I think he was sending a message that he was never going to allow the peace process to go further, and the negotiations to yield anything real. When he in the same way as the Khartoum Three Nos of years ago that you will remember, but. And he probably don't.
Mm-hmm.
But when he said, we're not going to have an end to claims and conflict, no recognition of a Jewish state, East Jerusalem is the capital. I mean, all of the things that he knows were either subject to negotiation, but certainly not given, that he knew some were red lines. Once he said those things, then it was a message that he was never going to come to an agreement. And many people have said all along, including Palestinians, that he will never come to agreement. It's not in his DNA. He is still Arafat's 40-year associate, and the same way Arafat walked away from deals, and he has walked away from very, or maybe even too generous offers, that it was apparent that that was exactly what the pattern was going to be again.
Right.
And the key here is that Israel the world has to see that it was not Israel. You know, they jump on a tender offer for houses, not a new settlement as NPR and CBS were talking about. You know, a new settlement is being built. This is Gilo. It's part of Jerusalem. It's an old tender that was reissued. The timing wasn't good, as often is the case. But it was not some sort of a provocative act that was meant to sabotage the deals. And if you look at the new textbook study that came out, you see that their textbooks continue to be full of incitements, calls for violence against Jews,
and
talks about pre-67 Israel.
Right, but with all of that, the only reason Israel canceled this release of the 26 terrorists was because the PA goes and applies for admission to these international treaties and conventions. With everything you just described, it took that to finally have Israel say no more.
No, it was actually before that, Nahum, that it was over the failure to move the process since November. And that is what Netanyahu and others cited. It was before the application for the UN, the 15 UN conventions, which is a prelude to going to the agencies. And he said even last night or this morning that he's going to continue with that process, not going to back off, something that Kerry and others raised. But Netanyahu already had said no or put off the release of the other prisoners who were supposed to be let out last Saturday night.
Right.
That was the deadline, saying that there's just no process. What progress? And what's the point of our continuing with gestures when there's nothing reciprocal happening?
Right. Some might ask what the difference is between this one and the other three prisoner releases.
Well, the first of all, the quality of the people was somewhat different. There were all terrorists, and many of them were killers. But these,
well, the guy portrayed in the New York Times front page story was certainly a murderer.
That's true. I said there were amongst them murders. This group was considered even more hardcore, more vicious, whatever. But
levels of murderers.
But yes, yeah, a level of terrorism. And
he's a level one murderer. Oh, he's a level two.
But the first two, the conditions were different. First of all, there were talks going on. But you've seen you had a Secretary of State who's visited there 15 times or 16 times, has tried. And the bottom line still is that the Palestinians are not forthcoming. Israel delivered on three of the four tranches of prisoners at expense, at political expense, at risk of security. Some of them have been rearrested or been involved in terrorism. Israel had every right to say at some point, well, what are we doing this for?
Right.
It was not to sabotage the peace. Israel has shown, and I think repeatedly shown, that they're willing to go the extra step. And Netanyahu, as you know, had a lot of opposition within his cabinet to all of this, and that's why the Pollard thing was not a bargaining chip as much as it was a sweetener. It was to give cover to Netanyahu to be able to go to his cabinet and say, look, if you reject this, you are all strong advocates for Pollard's release, we can get Pollard in the deal as well. And that was the intention, was, right, I believe, to sweeten the deal and facilitate Netanyahu being able to get it through the cabinet.
All right, so what's the Obama/Kerry attitude now toward the PA? What will the U.S., I don't want to say policy, because I don't know if it's going to be big enough to be a policy, but what direction will they go in now in terms of trying to pressure the PA to sit at a table, or in terms of easing up on the PA at this time?
Well, right now they may just withdraw generally from this and hold back and see whether the parties themselves, or whether anything will happen between them directly, or whether they will call for Kerry to return. As you know, Israel has said that Kerry was trying to be fair, and they have not been critical of his efforts. The Palestinians have been much more, and as I said, the speeches that Abbas has given, some of his media appearances, I mean, he talked about the failure, and, you know, Abbas is somebody who's in the 10th year of his four-year term. He's not a honestly elected official. He sits on top of a regime of corruption. He represents half of the group. You have Gaza, where, again, we saw rockets being fired and a deteriorating situation between Fatah and Hamas, contrary to some of the reports. And a really interesting billboard, which we should talk about in Gaza. So, you know, he comes into this in a weakened position. The Arab League sort of gave him cover. It's what he does, exactly what Arafat did, that every time he wants to be able to say no to something like Jewish state, he runs to the Arab League, gets a resolution, and say, oh, it's not me, you know. Jerusalem is a billion people have to vote on any concessions we would make on Jerusalem.
It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial, and around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Malcolm Honlein is with us, Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents and Major American Jewish Organizations, the weekly update here at JM and the AM. You know, it's interesting, I don't know when we last spoke about, I know we mentioned it last week because there was a decision that was ready to be made in terms of Ehud Olmert and his situation. But I think at different points in the last couple of years, we discussed how, I don't know if Israelis were numb to the whole thing already, or they had, as you said last week, a little bit sick and tired of the whole, you know, all the scandalous stuff that hits the papers in terms of government officials. But with all of that and all the background, I think there was something devastating about the final decision, the conviction that came through this past week of former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. Is that just me because I don't like these types of things in the headlines? Or would you say in Israel it also made a tremendous impact?
Tremendous impact. And I think that your earlier description is right. I think people are sick and tired of it. I told them that they could have a government in exile with a former president, former prime minister, all these others who are going to prison. But it is not a laughing matter. It's the image of Israel to the world. You know, every country has it. It's not unique to Israel. I don't even know if it's disproportionate.
But what was it about this? What was it about this week? It got me, and I'm sure as you're describing, it got so many people, especially in Israel. What do you think it was, especially for those who expected it? What was it that was so devastating?
Well, first of all, because of the level, the person was prime minister. And second, and although most of the crimes, I don't think that they alleged anything took place when he was prime minister. But Olmert also had such close relationships with people in the West, including myself. As mayor, he was engaged with everyone. There had always been rumors about, some shenanigans going on. But this, the devastating nature of this after his longtime assistant turned, and she didn't end up giving testimony. Now she's giving testimony that we could see another case being introduced against Olmert and on further corruption, and it involves businessmen, it involves others who gave him very significant amounts of money. I don't think he was a good criminal. Anybody who leaves $150,000 in cash in his office has got to have raised certain questions, and to the extent of it. But it comes on the heels of so many other cases over the last years that it's a cumulative effect where people, and I believe there needs to be some reform, and a really hard sentence that the message is clear to other Israeli politicians that it won't be tolerated.
And look how many other people went down in the same case, right? A whole list of people were convicted that day.
Well, 11 people were convicted, but it isn't over. It's still there's still an investigation going on, and as I said, another case with other people involved. And with her turning state evidence, she knows everything. She was his, many many year assistant and intimate in the dealings.
Right.
Knew all that was going on, took the cash, and may vindicate or underscore the testimony of somebody from the States who had earlier, seems like many years ago, gave testimony against Olmert.
When he's sentenced later this month, do you assume there'll be jail time?
I do.
That will be some scene, huh?
It'll be very sad, I think, not just for him and his family, but I think for Israel. And it's a message that Israel holds to account even the most powerful figures, and no one escapes justice.
Right. Before we get back to the Middle East, any reason to suspect that the Fort Hood attack of this week was jihad-related like the one 5 years ago?
No.
Nothing else?
I've asked the question and last night, and no evidence of it.
There are elections everywhere. We talk about the ones in Egypt in June, but I didn't realize this week there were local elections in Turkey, which were described as a victory for Erdogan and will help him, propel him to another term as president in Turkey. Is that how you would analyze the results of this week?
Yes, he ended up with, I think, 44% of the vote, his party did.
Right.
There are a lot of accusations of corruption and distortion in the polls. And it would not be surprising. I think he doesn't want to become president under the current terms. He wants to have a much more powerful presidency, but he is citing this as a mandate for him. And as you know, he has cracked down on everything from Twitter to the political opponents, imprisoning hundreds of generals, journalists, judges. I mean, he's going after everybody that could pose a potential challenge to him. So this was not the expected outcome. I think that people expected the AKP party, that's Erdogan's party, not to have done as well as it did. And he can ride it for now.
When is the national election? Very soon?
Well, there are both parliamentary and presidential elections next year.
Next year, meaning 2015?
I think 2015 is the is the presidential.
And in Afghanistan, there were also elections this week, right?
Today.
Oh, today's the election. And they are expecting the U.S. to complete its assistance program in Afghanistan at some point in the next year?
Well, they haven't renegotiated the deal, as far as I know. And I think, there will be expectations of an American pullout. And Karzai, our good friend, turned against. He can't run again, so there will be other people coming into power. You also have May 26th, the Egyptian elections, 26th and 27th.
Oh, it's May. I thought it was June, so it's May.
No, it's in May. A lot of things that are going to be taking place that are going to be very interesting. In the Turkish election, six people got killed. So you know the level of intensity, violence. Many people accused the police and officials of intimidation in the process of that election.
I don't remember if it was Turkey or Afghanistan where they said people would stay home because of the threat of, attacks.
You know, that's about the Taliban. That's
in Afghanistan.
In Turkey, you have a more and more repressive regime, and the impact on society is felt, and there are people... I think more people may leave, although the economy has not been bad as bad. And
what's the greatest fear? What's the greatest fear in Afghanistan for the West that there'll be no control at all over the Taliban, over Al Qaeda, because of no
they're coming back, and they're going to fill the void as the U.S. leaves, and that we're going to go back to the earlier situation.
And all these years later. It's a,
all these years, but look at Iraq. It's you can see what is the fear for Afghanistan is that we're going to see what we see in Iraq today, which is a government aligned with Iran, supplying people into Syria, the transfer point for the weapons that were on the Khalas Sea from Syria to Iraq to go to the Gaza to Iran, and of course going to the Gaza, and still at no price. And no consequence for Iran for doing this or many other things that it's done. But if you look at Iraq, you understand what is the potential danger that despite the huge trillions of dollars we spent, lives lost, we're seeing at best a split, an east-west split, and the Sunni-Shiite split, but that Iraq has turned into, again, a staging ground with Iran even more influential than it was.
And does the technological era as it stands today help more than in the past? I mean, is there a way to monitor all this without having men on the ground in every one of these countries?
Well, drones and other things play a role in Afghanistan. You see how the U.S. has used them. But frankly, boots on the ground, intelligence on the ground, Israel's learned it
But do you know how many countries we have to cover then?
Well, we're not going to. I mean, a part of the problem is America withdrawal, but also because the credibility of the West in these countries is so diminished that people feel that it's open season and that they can do what they want. And the increasing message, I mean, when we look at and I think particularly the events in Iran are what is important. Look how Iran slapped the United States and the West, but particularly the United States, by appointing as its ambassador to the UN one of the guys who held 55 Americans hostage for 444 days in Tehran.
Right.
He's the UN ambassador. Thank God there are senators now working to deny him a visa. The administration will. I know that they're talking about it. But it is unbelievable. And you see Iran's provocations, whether it's their submarines in the Gulf doing things, whether it's support for terrorism globally, especially in South America and other places, how they're organizing Hezbollah intelligence now for further crackdowns, how the negotiations with Russia now for a $20 billion deal of oil for goods and two more reactors, but amongst those, quote, goods are missiles, new missile shipments and things. And they keep going ahead and doing these things. And what is the response that we see in a Voice of America broadcast? American officials praise the Khamenei for a fatwa, a religious ruling, banning the development and use of nuclear weapons, yet nowhere does this fatwa appear. There are 493 published, and there's a website of Khamenei. Nowhere does it mention such a fatwa. So what price is there? What when they look at this and they say, what is the price that is paid for those who engage and violate their understandings and who provoke, so it becomes open season.
Spoke this week with somebody who left Syria in the year 2000, and they said that, frankly, Israel needs Assad to remain in power in Syria. If not, if in fact he's toppled, the chaotic situation that will commence in the Middle East will be impossible for Israel to deal with. Do you think there's anything to that theory?
Yes, there are a lot of people who think that, and that the best thing right now is the status quo, in a sense, not that so many people, maybe 200,000, have been killed, and you know, 1 million refugees from Syria just in Lebanon, and that a very significant part of the population, internally and externally, have been refugees. And but the bottom line is that there's no one there, none of the parties that would be acceptable, that would be better. We don't see, you know, forces of moderation. Quite the opposite. Iran has extended its influence there. Hezbollah has extended its influence. They had a big victory in that village that we talked about near the Lebanon border, but it's a supply route. And we see the new assertiveness, and then the response. But I think that the anti-Assad forces are weaker today. So you may have just this continuing, and there's no evidence that Assad will be out of office anytime soon. We have to be concerned about the continuing fighting and the training of thousands of people. And we see already the ramifications that the Prime Minister of Britain said that they have to investigate about the Muslim Brotherhood and about these guys and about attacks in the Middle East and coming to Great Britain. But that half of the time of the MI5, their intelligence is spent on these guys who are fighting in Syria, the infiltration in Britain of different Islamist groups. And the truth is, the same thing is true here in the United States. So the ramifications of what happens in Syria is not going to be limited to its borders, but I think you're going to see Iran more bold down because of it, Hezbollah in the north, Hamas being excited in the south, shooting more rockets. It's all interrelated, and that's what I kept saying for so many years, that in the age of globalization, we see it. We see it there playing out on a mini scale, but it's really happening on a global scale.
All right. Well, as you've said, I mean, Iran is basically Syria, is basically Lebanon, right? It's all basically the same effort that's going on. That's why Israel has to be so concerned.
And the continued drive for the Shiite Crescent and for the more and more dominant role, and the violations of the sanctions. You see that they have every month exceeded the export of oil limitation that was placed on them.
Right.
And we continue just to negotiate. There were negotiations last week. Doesn't seem that much came out of it. But the West sits at the table, and it becomes a joke.
By the way, what does Assad think of when he sees Putin and his activities in Ukraine and Crimea? Anything? Like, does it affect him one way or the other?
Yes, he says, you owe me a thank you.
Basically, right?
But it is true that,
right,
that events lead and send messages, and it's not just in the Ukraine, then it's China,
right,
in the China Sea, and North Korea, and every rogue state looks at this and says, look, you can get away with it. This is the time,
right,
when the West is so weak, when the price you pay is so limited, and unless we really ratchet it up in serious ways, and I'm not talking about having to go to war, nobody wants to see,
right,
American troops being sent everywhere. That isn't where you have to draw the line.
By the way, I saw an interview with George Will on this topic this week, and he said the reason he's surprised that U.S. sanctions or statements are not or cannot be more effective is because we keep talking about the dependence of Europe on Russia at this point, right? We keep talking about the energy pipeline. He said that Putin is so desperate for the cash that he can't believe that the United States can't be so, and Europe can't be somewhat stronger, even if they're dependent on what's coming out of Russia, because he's so desperate for this cash flow to continue.
I agree with that, and I think you could even go further, that Putin, I think, is very shrewd and has handled this intelligently, because Russia is not a great power. Russia's economy teeters. It's dependent. If we lower the price of oil significantly, Russia is the big victim of it, and he does not have the internal,
right,
economic strength.
It's less money for him.
It's much less,
right,
money, much less, but he's making all these deals. He's in the meantime, selling weapons to Iran and Syria, and people think that this is some ideological position. He doesn't want to protect his port in Latakia in Tartus in Syria, because it's the only port they have in the Mediterranean, et cetera. But and he has ideological goals and to challenge the United States. But he's signing multi-billion-dollar deals with Iran, and he's still selling the weapons to Syria. And the idea that Russia is a great power and we can't challenge him,
right.
Of course we can challenge him. And if we don't draw the line someplace, you see that now they talk about Moldova, they talk about other places.
But
there'll be no limit.
But nobody has the guts to stand up and take that risk. I mean, George Will was saying, if you offer half price, he ain't turning off the spigot no matter what.
Because he needs the money.
Right.
Their economy is...
So they should try it. Next time you speak with European leaders, I need you to suggest this to them.
Oh, believe me, we do.
And they don't... Nobody.
I met this week with some of them, and many of them express tremendous frustration as well. But they're not showing the leadership that we would hope. By the way, it was an interesting story that nobody paid attention to that I think is important. You know that 30 students from Al-Quds and Beir Zayed went to Auschwitz this week.
Whoa.
The Palestinians with a professor to study the Shoah, the Holocaust, and now they've been condemned on their return and are being threatened and harassed. But they knew it, but when they went...
What do you think? What do you think of their premise to go?
That there are people there who want to see beyond the moment, that even on,
right.
within all of this, there are still some bright lights. But I have to tell you about this billboard.
Oh, yeah, what's the billboard story?
In Gaza, which nobody picked up, but it's really interesting to me because it tells you what they're thinking, where they're headed. And you know that in Egypt, they're going into this election, and so the whole country is tied up in it, and they're still cracking down in the Sinai and have cracked down on Gaza. In Hamas put up a huge billboard, and as you know, this was their way either to taunt Israelis, the West, and to do political advertising. But this is a huge billboard, several stories high, and it has the leadership of the Arab world, and it shows Khania and Mashal of Hamas, the leaders of Qatar, Al-Thani and Tamim, and Erdogan of Turkey.
Hmm.
And they put this up and send this message to the world that these are, because those are the ones who are now providing them with aid and with assistance, and from whom they want to get more money. But and they talk about, you know, getting Jerusalem back and et cetera.
Do you think Erdogan minds being in that company?
Erdogan is part of that company. That's exactly the message. And when we look at it and people talk about him, you know, that he's a member of NATO and that he's this is the real orientation of Erdogan. I think that's why the outcome of the election is of such concern to people, and why we should all be concerned about what he's done. That Turkey is a significant player. The economy has been badly hurt, and he has a lot of internal distractions as well. But I think that the fact that they put up this billboard, it's a political message, but it's much more than that. And the extension now of Hamas, Hezbollah, now rebuilding internally, by the way, and we know that they're helping to build the forces in Syria, but they're also trying to extend it, and they're involved all over the world. The level of their involvement, sponsored by Iran, is increasing all the time, and the same thing with Hamas. It was the new assertiveness with the missiles and stuff flying over the border and attempts to shoot people, the big tunnels that were found. These are all indications, and it shouldn't be lost because people are focused on the collapse of the process or particular negotiations. You've got to look at what's happening on the ground all the time.
Who did you mention was cracking down in this conversation on the social media? That was Erdogan?
Erdogan was the one who closed the Twitter down.
Right.
And he's now reopened it, but it was actually a popular move inside Turkey.
Right.
I don't understand, but not amongst young people.
Hey, come on. Even segments of our own community would be thankful if Twitter was closed down.
As somebody who doesn't tweet or Twitter, and
yeah,
I don't care.
Will you be visiting Ehud Olmert in prison, or is that a private matter which you would not discuss publicly?
He's not in prison yet, so it's premature.
Don't you want to plan in advance? Malcolm, next week, Shabbat Hagadol, your pre-Passover message. Please prepare accordingly.
Stop baking
matzahs. Malcolm Holine is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Have a wonderful Shabbos.
Good job.